So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
Did you know that prostate cancer is linked to birth control? Hold up. You may say, well, I'm a dude. I don't take birth control. What are you talking about, Timory? Well, I'll explain this in just a minute. Father Tim Grumbach will join me shortly to discuss sports and how we can maintain healthy competition in our lives. Coming up later on this week, should Catholics watch horror films? There's a study that came out close to 10 years ago now, and it was reported even in Time, Health, and Family. That's right, Time Magazine covered this. And guess what the story pointed to? A, quote, curious link between birth control pills and prostate cancer. Here's the deal. A medical journal, BMJ Journals, ended up producing a study by David Margol and Neil Fleshman, and in it they showed that indeed there has been not only an increase in prostate cancer, but it's actually linked to birth control. Gentlemen, no, I'm not saying that dudes are taking birth control, although, I mean, it's practically the same thing with all this hormone replacement therapy. We are neutering and totally changing the hormonal chemical makeup of the body with hormone replacement therapy for people who identify as so-called transgender. But back to the contraception issue, it's all related, but we'll stay focused here for a second. So essentially, more women taking birth control is linked to higher rates of prostate cancer. Now, we've seen as studies continue to grow that, in fact, most men at the end of their life actually have prostate cancer. It might not be the cause of their death, but it's become far more prominent, especially in developed nations, where we see an increase in hormonal contraception. How? Well, this is actually related to another study I mentioned last week when I talked about how contraception is linked to not just prostate cancer, but breast cancer and other forms of cancer as well. There's a study that came out of the University of Colorado's Integrated Physiology Department, and it showed a study of the river in Boulder, Colorado. And what it did is it looked at the water and what came out, both in this study and in the study linking contraception to prostate cancer, is that indeed there's actually hormonal contraception in our water supply. Now, a woman, when she takes hormonal contraception, some of that is passed through urination. Now, what we've seen is, although that might be a trace amount, when you have this happening on a massive scale with the vast majority of women, unfortunately even Catholic women, taking hormonal contraception, this actually becomes a really big deal for the bottom line, the health of men and women. And I find it very interesting. When we look at this entire topic, what's the big picture here? Well, why is contraception causing cancer? If you didn't know this, synthetic forms of estrogen and progesterone, which are the two primary ingredients in hormonal contraception, are actually labeled as group 1 carcinogens. That's right, cancer-causing agents. Just to cite three sources, in fact, this isn't just Timory or the Catholic Church saying that. In fact, I've said nothing about my Catholic faith with regard to contraception and prostate cancer. So you can't go around saying that Catholics are claiming that people are going to get cancer as some sort of sinful judgment for having taken contraception. No, the science is pretty clear on this. And here are those three sources just to know that the fact that hormonal contraception, specifically the ingredients estrogen and progesterone, are shown by the United Nations as being recognized as a group 1 carcinogen, the Cancer Research Center in the United Kingdom, and the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, among many others. This isn't just a hidden thing that Catholics are trying to use to scare you out of contraception. I've said this many times before. I think that we have a really incredible opportunity with regard to the contraception conversation to talk to women and men about how it's not a healthy choice for their bodies. Now, if we were to look at this big picture, it's interesting to me. When we alter the natural functions of the human body, we see consequences from a scientific perspective. When we alter the body's natural function to conceive children, when we alter the body's natural function in terms of the hormone makeup as a man or a woman, when we take shortcuts in life, there are widespread consequences. We see two things. We're seeing a very common theme in today's culture: the physical degeneration of the human person, where we have worse health quality, higher and higher medical expenses than ever before. And we're also living in a culture that is struggling to produce virtue, to even develop a virtue. I think it's because we're constantly trying to take a shortcut or alter the way our body functions. The virtuous life leads to better health, body and soul. Look, hormonal contraception use is literally impacting the bottom line of cancer for men, cancer for women, increased numbers in breast cancer, prostate cancer. We can't deny the fact that when we try to manipulate the human body, when we try to neuter it, when we try to make it something it's not with hormonal replacement therapy, we're creating long-term consequences that we don't even know the full impact of. Who would have thought when hormonal contraception became widespread in the culture that it would lead to cancer? Well, actually, there were studies even at that time linking the two, but no one wanted to talk about it. And it's not fair that women aren't told the consequences. There's a documentary that came out some time ago titled Sweetening the Pill. And it's interesting because it came out from a secular perspective, really hitting on the fact that indeed we live in a culture that doesn't want any steroids in our dairy, doesn't want any hormone replacements in our food, no pesticides, non-GMO. We could go on and on. Everything's organic, at least here in California. And yet we're willing to put hormonal contraception to our bodies that do some of the exact same things we're trying to avoid with the types of healthy food lifestyles and fitness lifestyles that we're choosing. Let's get to the deeper issue here, and we're going to talk about that later on, and that is the innate desire for motherhood, and how yet again when we try to go outside of the context of conceiving a child between a man and a woman in the intimate act of love between the two spouses, things get pretty confusing. So stay tuned, we'll be talking about that in just a little bit. My guest today is Father Tim Grumbach. If you'd like to join the conversation or have a question, the number's 1-888-914-9149, or you can head over to my Instagram story that I've just posted, and you can go ahead and ask us a question. Let us know, we'll be checking that during the show to touch on your topic of choice, specifically having to do with sportsmanship and healthy competition in our lives. Father Tim Grumbach is here on Trending with Tim Ray. He's a regular guest for a number of years now, and he is from the Diocese of Los Angeles, working at St. Augustine Parish as an associate pastor. And Father Tim, you're pretty worked up right now because of the World Series. Let's talk about this in relation to having a healthy sense of competition in our hearts.
Oh my gosh, I've been waiting almost my whole life to be able to talk about this, about watching my Los Angeles Dodgers win the World Series. And they finally did that last night. And we were just kind of texting back and forth a little bit, trying to figure out what to talk about today. And I was so funny. I was like, oh, if the Dodgers win tonight, we have to talk about it tomorrow. And so one of the reasons I so wanted them to win last night was so we could talk about it today rather than, you know, the suspense of having to wait until tonight for a game seven. But a lot of joy, because the last time the Dodgers won the World Series, I was 4 years old. So I don't remember very much of it. There was just so many great stories. My older brother and my dad got to go to game one of the World Series in 1988. And it was one of the greatest moments in Dodger baseball history. Was Kurt Gibson hit his home run walk off against one of the greatest closers at the time, Dennis Eckersley, you know, who just threw a slider and it didn't quite get down low enough. And Kirk Gibson hit it out. And you can see people driving out of the parking lot because they thought the game was over. There was no way the Dodgers were coming back. And so it's just this lore that has been passed down in my family that my dad and my brother were at that game. They were there for that moment. And people, you know, there are probably 100,000 people in the city who will say they were at that game.
But my dad and my brother were there too.
But my dad and my brother were actually there. And so we've been waiting and we've been so close the last few years to just celebrate as a city. And one of my favorite moments of being able to celebrate this was to be able to troll the Giants fans on Twitter who are trying to troll Dodgers fans because this was a shortened season because of COVID. And so some Giants fans got on there and said, look, the Dodgers won 43 games this season. That is a record low for a team that won the World Series. Congratulations, a record that will never be broken.
Oh, boo.
So I got right back to them and said, and yet somehow the Giants were able to be 14 games behind the Dodgers in the regular season somehow. How about that?
Father, you're definitely back on Twitter.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that is about as much polemic as I'm willing to enter into on Twitter these days. But that's what sports does for us. And I love sports. One of the best examples of the way that sports changes our mindset of the way we view each other, but also interact and, you know, for the good and for the bad is my mom grew up in Michigan. So I'm a Michigan Wolverines fan. And so every time I see the red and white or the red and silver of Ohio State, I just cringe. Like whenever I see the black and orange of the Giants of San Francisco, I just cringe. It's why I hate Halloween, because it's all black and orange everywhere.
But they're not really that great colors anyways.
So there was this ESPN ad a few years ago, and it showed a guy wearing a Michigan sweatshirt and a girl wearing an Ohio State sweatshirt, and they were kissing. And all the ad said, if it weren't for sports, this wouldn't be gross. You know? So just the rivalry that comes from sport can be such a healthy thing. But it also, it does speak into our culture and speak into our lives and the way that we're able to relate to people. So whenever I come across somebody who's like, oh, I love Ohio State, I love the Buckeyes, I'm like, ew, gross, how are we friends? Or I love the Giants, I'm like, ew, don't ever speak to me again. And I can say that I bleed Dodger blue, and people hate it when I say that if they're from San Francisco or somewhere else in the country. And so sports, it's part of our culture, and it can be good, it can be bad. It can lead to great conversations and friendships and challenges with one another. But it can also become something ugly. I know there are some friends of mine who are afraid to go to Dodger Stadium when they play the Giants, because sometimes the rivalry bleeds itself into the fans. And we have had violence in the parking lot at Dodger Stadium before.
This is why you just have to go to an Angels game. It's way more peaceful, Father Tim. Come on. I mean, the Angels. I grew up Angels fan here.
Someone said on Twitter yesterday that there are two teams in Los Angeles. I'm like, what are you talking about? They're not even in the same county. Yeah.
Well, they're fake in the same county. I'm still heartbroken over the fact that the Anaheim Angels suddenly became the Los Angeles Angels. It just does not work.
The Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. You know, that's almost as gross as watching somebody wearing a Michigan sweatshirt and someone wearing an Ohio State sweatshirt kissing each other, right? But what does this have to do with our faith? I mean, right, it speaks so much into our culture, a culture of competition. And the way that competition, especially among men, is supposed to be something that builds us up as individuals and as community, but that some ways it can lead to violence, and some ways it can lead to unhealthy interaction, unhealthy relationship. And we need to be aware of the way that is affecting us in our interpersonal lives, and to recognize the way that sports is meant to build us up and to bring, yes, entertainment, but also motivation and challenge and growth, rather than to be something of division.
The male psyche in competition is so fascinating to me, Father Tim. And if you're just joining us, that's Father Tim Grumbach. You're listening to Trending with Tim Murray here on Relevant Radio. Now, this competition can be seen in sports teams that we follow, the sports that we play. It's also seen as a huge motivator, specifically for men, with regard to fitness and staying healthy. I know some guys, you know, they will only work out if they have that person who can, you know, counter and challenge them. We're going back to the Epic of Gilgamesh. I mean, it's fundamental to the human person, especially men, to have competition and to be challenged and driven by someone that matches them. And this is a good reminder for us in our faith journey, in our friendships, that we need that healthy competition. But how do we keep it balanced and in the right context?
Right. And you bring up like that epic of Gilgamesh and just even the very Babylonian mindset of what it took for creation to happen was that you had the god of light, Marduk, who had to fight against the other gods to prove his place in the pantheon and to create using the torn up corpse of his enemy, and how Israel could speak into that and says, well, our God doesn't compete. Our God doesn't have to compete with other creatures, with other gods. And so perhaps that's a little bit of necessary insight for what competition can do for us, is it's not meant to be something merely to prove ourselves, but it's meant to be something that builds us up. It's a creative act in a certain sense. And so to be able to use that competition as a man, I know the joy of being able to get on my bike and go out with a group and like make the rest of the group hurt going up a hill. Right? It's like, I almost don't even have to win the race up the hill, just as long as I made people hurt. And it's not a matter of like, I don't like those people, so I want them to hurt. But it's like, even if I lost, did I get better because of that loss? Did I learn something? Did I get stronger because of it? And so competition is not all about winning. And that's definitely something that has seeped its way into our culture and into our society, is that competition isn't worth it unless we win. But I know, you know, very much so from even my surf contests. Like if the surf is so good out there, if it's like shoulder high and just peeling and offshore, and it's like you're out there with maybe three or four other guys and it's empty and you get to have it all to yourself. And well, maybe they got better waves. Maybe they surfed better. But you just got to surf like the best waves of your life all by yourself out there. And you know, was the competition really about winning? Or was it about being able to enjoy something that you wouldn't have otherwise? And so competition doesn't need to be about winning, but about this growth and this maturation, but also an appreciation for what it takes to lose with class.
I keep bringing this back to the Epic of Gilgamesh and how Gilgamesh didn't really kind of transform his life and work hard until he had someone else who was challenging him. Now, it's fascinating because I'll see many people who suddenly get involved, let's say, in their faith, specifically men, and they love the competition in their faith. And maybe they suddenly cling to apologetics or being know-it-alls with regard to the faith, which is great, but it can, at a certain point, kind of turn into this unhealthy obsession for competition rather than the competition forging virtue within the person and really pointing toward developing that prayer life that's so important.
Yeah, and I know we're talking especially about a masculine spirituality when it comes to competition, but I think something that really speaks well into this was I was just watching on Netflix. I know I've tried to stay away from Netflix as much as possible, but there's this great new show on it called The Queen's Gambit, which is all about chess. And it's about this young girl who becomes this chess prodigy, and she is just destroying her competition left and right, but also being an orphan and having to deal in unhealthy ways with a sense of abandonment, but also to recognize her talents in the midst of a male-dominated competition. Was that she would dive into drug addiction and alcohol abuse and isolation. And she was quoted in the show as saying that, you know, chess is so predictable. It's a whole world in 64 squares. And I know that if I get hurt in that world, it's my own fault. And it's just this incredible temptation, whether it be in the masculine or feminine heart in competition, to isolate oneself and say, I have to have control over every element of this competition and isolate myself and obsess myself to become the best. Otherwise, it's not worth entering into this competition. And so by the end of the series, it's kind of an uplifting look into the need for friendship and the need for a team, even in an individual sport like chess. And so I think that really does speak into the temptation towards hiding within our competition, isolating ourselves from those who can teach us in order to try to be the best all by ourselves.
Can you still encourage another person even when you're being competitive? Because I think that this is the balance. We can go to two extremes. I think you can, but you have to keep your competitiveness in check. What do you think?
Oh, yes. And that show, you know, The Queen's Gambit, speaks into that as well, is that almost every character that she tries to push away is trying to help her. It says, you are so talented. You are so brilliant. And she still tries to push them away. And so there's a danger that the people who are trying to help us, who may be better than us, we may want to push them away because we don't want to lose. And so in competition, pushing each other is what makes the competition what it is. All the greatest athletes and the greatest competitors in the world will all say that they're probably most grateful for the people who were better than them. They're probably most grateful for the people who challenged them the most. Because if someone is so talented, they're not going to get any more talented just by, you know, destroying their opponents time after time. They need to learn by facing someone who will challenge them.
Gentlemen, do you struggle in your prayer life? Father Tim and I will be right back to discuss sportsmanship, both on and off the field, and how it relates to the virtues of justice and charity. We'll be right back.
So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
What do you say? Should Catholics watch horror films with Halloween coming up? It's that time of year, popcorn, movies, Hocus Pocus, When a Stranger Calls, Chucky. Some of those really scary ones have to do with demons that I won't even name, or witches. What do you think? Should Catholics watch horror films? Head over to my Instagram story where I threw up this question. I would love to hear from you. I'll actually discuss this from a Catholic perspective on Friday. But first, let me know your thoughts by commenting on Instagram. My guest, Father Tim Grumbach, we've been talking a lot about masculine spirituality, healthy competition. We know St. Joseph, which, by the way, we talk a lot about St. Joseph on Wednesdays, specifically because there's been this tradition in the church that many of the days of the week have a specific dedication or theme. For example, Friday, a day of penance and fasting, remembering the death of our Lord Jesus Christ and his sacrifice on the cross. Saturdays, the theme is Our Lady. We have also on Sunday, the theme of the resurrection. I could go on through some of the other themes, but the one that we've been focusing on Wednesdays is specifically St. Joseph. And we've been talking about some of his litany titles, such as St. Joseph, who's called Joseph Most Just. Now, I thought that this was interesting in relation to the theme of competition and sportsmanship with the World Series that just occurred. Father Tim, how do you view St. Joseph's title, Most Just, in relation to sportsmanship on and off the field?
Well, thinking about sportsmanship on and off the field is that it requires a certain teamsmanship, right? Of bringing other people into your circle, bringing them in to make you better, to cast out the mediocrity among you and to challenge you. But also that it requires a certain amount of obedience to be a sportsman, doesn't it? Is that there are rules established to play, that, and they're not rules meant merely to constrain you, but to allow you to become the best that you can be at that sport, right? In basketball, there are rules about dribbling. You can't just run across the court with the ball in your hands without dribbling it. Otherwise, you'll be a terrible basketball player. You have to follow these rules, especially baseball. You know, looking at the Dodgers winning the World Series, they're you know, like one of my favorite things that Bishop Barron always brings up is that you don't start by handing somebody the rule book and say, this is baseball, right? You put them onto the field, you let them feel the dirt, you let them feel the grass. And then they learn the rules along the way, and they learn the rules of obedience once they've learned the rules of beauty. And so to look at St. Joseph as, you know, Joseph the Most Just is really, that's the highest compliment that a first century Jew could receive, is to be referred to as a just man. It's such a beautiful thing to reflect on that, because Pope Benedict, when he wrote his beautiful little book about the infancy narratives in Matthew and in Luke, he focused for a moment on that title for Joseph, that it's just a real brief mention, but it says that he was a just man. And for a first century Jew, that harkens back into Psalm 1 and Jeremiah 17, is that the just man is the one who knows the word of God in his heart. And he's like a tree that's planted by running waters, so that even in the heat, he is soaking up that water, that he doesn't go dry when the rest of the world is going dry around him. And so that Joseph didn't just make one just act in this moment that he took Mary into his home, but this was something that, you know, he was defined as a just man. This is something he had been doing and preparing for his whole life. It wasn't a difficult decision for him, because this is who he was, to make this just decision. And so it meant that he was able to be obedient in a certain, well, in a major extent, by listening to his dreams, so that Joseph knew the difference between just any regular old dream, and he had this interior life to know that when the angel came to him in a dream, he wasn't just making this up. This was God speaking to him. And so this obedience to the rules of sportsmanship that make us not constrained, but make us greater. I think that's at the heart of who Joseph is as a just man, is his obedience to the word of God as a just man from Psalm 1, but also his obedience in his interior life that was not obsessive, but was what made him who he was, that he was a deeply pious and a trusting man, that the law that God had given to his people was going to make him great.
That's Father Tim Grumbach. You're listening to Trending with Timory. I think often, Father Tim, when we talk about justice as a virtue, we get a little confused as a kind of a 20th century or 21st century mindset, American mindset too. We think justice is that just reward when someone gets nailed for something they did wrong. You know, we kind of have this attitude of justice as punishment, but that's actually the opposite in many ways of what it is. Justice is a virtue, and the virtue of justice has to do with giving others their due, what is essentially their right, what they should receive. And so the greatest example of this is we have to start with giving the justice that's appropriate to God. That includes our prayer, you know, dedicating our day to him, thanking him. You know, this is why Sunday was set apart as one of the first commandments by God, one of the first things he did, that would be the Lord's day, the Sabbath day, you know, that focus that was so integral to the human person. Because if we have our relationship with God right, then our relationship with others really begins to work itself out. And this is why Saint Joseph is the most just, because he understands his responsibility before God and then his responsibility to his wife, Our Lady. And this is what helps, I think, specifically men, Father Tim, in really rendering that due service to others as the leader and protector and provider of their home.
And I love that you bring in Joseph's justice having to do with his family and his relationship with his family, with Mary and with Jesus. And though Joseph never speaks a word in scripture, I like to think that we hear Joseph's speech and we see his actions through the way that Jesus interacts with people, right? You know, Jesus is God, that he knows at a deeper level than we do in our humanity. But that there were certain things that Jesus had to learn, and he learned them from Joseph. You can imagine Joseph teaching Jesus certain prayers, like the great Shema prayer of Israel. Or I'd like to imagine that Joseph is the one that taught Jesus how to wash feet, or how to lift women up when they had been cast down by others. So I'd love to see in Jesus's greatest actions that Joseph had taught him, maybe not why to do those things, but how to do those things in a certain sense, so that we witness Joseph's justice by the way that Jesus perfects it in his own ministry. So to look at the way that Joseph is made visible, even though he's not in the rest of the Gospels, through the actions and the words of Jesus.
Now, justice is different from charity. So let's break this down a little bit to clarify the two separate virtues. Can you explain that?
Yes. So you had defined it so beautifully already, that that justice is what we give to others, which is what they deserve, what is due to them. And we as Christians understand this very deeply, that it's not just what's due to them and what they deserve, but what is due to them and what they deserve for the sake of their flourishing. But then charity takes on something very much deeper. It's a fulfillment of justice, actually. It's not anything less than justice. It's a fulfillment of justice, and that it gives to the other what actually belongs to us. So that you could see this great tradition in the church of looking at the cross as something that we deserve in a certain sense, that Jesus took on in a certain sense, the punishment that we deserve for our sinfulness, is that Jesus didn't give us that punishment as we deserved it, but he took it on himself and he gave us himself. And so in charity, which fulfills the justice, Jesus gave us himself on the cross to fulfill the charity that is overflowing from the heart of God. And so it's not the image of God wanting to destroy us because of our sin, and then Jesus jumps in the way on the cross and takes all the wrath from God. That's not Catholic. I dare say that's not even Christian. But rather, it's a Jesus giving himself so completely in an act of charity that goes beyond justice. Doesn't ignore justice, but goes beyond justice. You know, this is so much on my heart right now, because there's something happening here at the parish these last couple of days. I know I said we won't talk about this. There's a lot that I can't talk about right now as we just work things out here at the parish. But it just has to do with some of our homeless brothers and sisters here at the parish, and some of the issues coming up with safety here at the parish. Is that everyone's okay, but there's just been a lot going on that we'll talk about some other time. But we're just trying to find the right way to balance, you know, what's just and what's charitable for those who might be, you know, damaging some of our property and might be dangerous for themselves and for others. Is that, do we just call the police and have them arrested and taken away so that we feel safer and they're out of our hair? Or do we have to find a way where, is that the safest thing for them? Is that the thing that is most charitable to them? You know, they might deserve to be arrested for something they've done on our property, but is that really going to be the best, most charitable thing, where we don't just give them what they deserve, but we give them what we deserve? We look at Jesus on the cross and say, you know, I need to see this person who has maybe damaged my property and maybe even been unsafe to my person. Do I look at them as Jesus looks at them on the cross and find a way to love them? And so it's really, really challenging when you come face to face with somebody that you want to give them just justice, but the Lord is asking us to give them charity and to fulfill the justice that they deserve.
And that requires generosity. It's taking from what you have to give to others. And this is what the season of Advent and Lent are all about. It's so important that we take advantage of these liturgical seasons, because all of the fasting, all of the giving up of things is essentially supposed to be there so that we could give more out of charity, giving what is ours, whether it be our money, whether it be our time, whether it be that item that we exactly gave up during Lent and Advent to give to someone else. And it makes me think even of this last happy hour that we had on Monday, where we talked about the scientific dimension of, like, there actually being a guide to happiness with Jim O'Day. And part of that scientific guide and checklist to following your path to happiness has to do with others, with giving to others, with gratitude and generosity. This actually transforms us. And this is a challenge in today's culture, where we don't like to bear fruit. We don't like to do things that other people don't necessarily see. And when we do something, we tend to want to post on social media and be a little braggadocious about it.
Right. And we're always afraid to do something that doesn't bear fruit, or at least fruit that we don't get to see. And that they may keep us from doing some of the littlest things. I know it's such a topic of controversy to say anything about face masks, right? But I'm not going to say anyone has to or doesn't have to, but I'm trying to see it almost like the modern day hair shirt, you know, something where the reasons for wearing it are something that's private between me and God. And it might not be something I want to do, but maybe I can wear it in such a way that I'm not going to see the fruit of this. And I may not even think there is any fruit to this, but it's something that is going to challenge me and be uncomfortable for me. And I'm going to do this at a personal level and just ask God to make something fruitful out of this, to let it become a prayer. Mm-hmm. And so I know that's not where everyone is at, but I'm trying to see face masks right now as a bit of a hair shirt. So a prayer that makes me uncomfortable, but ultimately does invite me into the experience of the cross, of Jesus's generosity, where he stepped beyond justice and what was expected and demanded for our sin, and made it into charity, took the greatest act of violence and injustice against the Son of God and turned it into the greatest act of love given to us by God.
That's Father Tim Grumbach here on Trending with Timory. We've tagged him on Instagram and Twitter if you'd like to stay in touch, especially if perhaps maybe you're home and you want to see a live-streamed Mass, to learn a little bit more about the liturgy. You can follow him on social media to learn more. I'll be right back, and I'll talk about this innate desire for motherhood in a photo I saw not too long ago that confused me so much. Not only did I do a double take, but I sat there staring at this photo, trying to figure out what was going on and why it seemed so confusing to me. I'll be right back.
We're talking about what you're thinking about. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Okay, so I was traveling across the country not too long ago, and I'm sitting here spending way too much time on social media, and next thing you know, this photo comes across my screen, and it's a story that's being featured on Oprah's Instagram, and I'm looking at the photo, and how cute, that's a baby announcement, but boy, that girl, you know, it's weird how they photoshopped that photo because that girl looks really old and then really young. And I move past it, and a couple minutes later, I'm still thinking about this baby announcement photo on Oprah's page. And I didn't read any of the description. I go back, and here's this happy couple holding an ultrasound photo making their baby announcement. But in the photo is the girl, the wife, with her hand reached back behind her, and back to back is her and another woman who looks very similar to her. It's her mother. I'm telling you, she looked very, very similar. I thought, wow, she's really aged in that photo. How weird, weird Photoshop. No, this is the announcement. This woman ended up going through with her husband in vitro fertilization and choosing a surrogate. And the person who offered to be their surrogate was her 51-year-old athletic mother, who's in great shape. That's right. So her mom is carrying her baby conceived via in vitro fertilization. Okay, so I'm telling you, the image itself was mind-boggling to me, but I'm sitting here and I'm looking at it, and I'm reading these other headlines this week. There's a story that came out on the Huffington Post. I never expected to find a sperm donor on Tinder. Here's how and here's why I did it. Ultimately, why did someone do it? This is the resounding cry of our culture today. Women want to be mothers. Even if they delay having children for years, even if they've chosen contraception, even if they've had abortions, women look back and they want to be a mother. This is even the story my guest on Friday, Kim Zembar, is going to share her story about her struggle with sexuality, specifically same-sex attraction, and how even in the women that she dated, there was a point where one of them wanted to be a mother. A biological mother, and wanted to go through with in vitro fertilization all of the different moving pieces in order to have a child of her own, even in the midst of the type of relationship that she was living in. We are living in a very confusing time with regard to having children, but we can't ignore the fact, again, of that innate desire for motherhood that is so real. And I'm watching my friends, I'm looking around and I'm seeing my friends, millennials, even those younger than me, who are discovering this ideal of motherhood or of marriage, of plain house that they suddenly have in their mind. And they're suddenly desperately reaching for marriage, for a husband, for a wife, for a home. Again, for that plain house, even to the point where they perhaps move in with someone because they're trying to work toward that ideal, but they can't quite figure it out. Now, at the same time, I recently saw on a friend's Instagram page, she had posted, and she was rather triggered because she started receiving advertisements for in vitro fertilization, adopting children and so forth. And she realizes, wow, Instagram is literally targeting me. What, do they know that I'm a single millennial who's still not married, dating, or who hasn't had kids? And you know what I saw there? Social media and targeted ad marketing knows exactly what's on the hearts and minds of young people today. They want to have a family. They want to go outside of themselves, but they don't quite know how to go about it. Will we allow this to continue to be what our culture is standing for? Of trying, but trying a little too late. This is what I see when I see that story of that photo I mentioned. Brianna and Aaron were married. Brianna had practiced using hormonal contraception for quite a while. She said, I kind of always thought it was going to happen really quickly. You spend your whole life preventing, that is using contraception. And she goes on to say, and when you stopped preventing, it doesn't happen right away. After a few months of trying to conceive and struggling with a miscarriage, her and her husband very quickly turned to in vitro fertilization after some of those miscarriages. Now, remember, often hormonal makeup can be thrown off from a long period of time of using contraception. The sad part of Brianna's story is actually that through one of those miscarriages, she ended up having afterward to remove the baby who had died from her womb. She had a DNC procedure, which is also known as a procedure that's used on a live baby in the instance of an abortion. It's a dilation and curettage. And this is what's really sad. So often women are told there is no consequence for having an abortion, having a DNC, having any type of abortion, but that's a lie. And this is one part of Brianna's story that I really appreciate. She actually says, no, this isn't true. In fact, she shares that because of the DNC she had to remove the baby after she miscarried, after the baby had died, she said, this actually, what happens is in this case, the scar tissue from that DNC was all over inside of her uterus and made it next to impossible for her to continue to have children. It's a type of condition called Asherman's syndrome that she developed as a result of a DNC after a miscarriage. This is what's very common for many women who have an abortion. So when people say that abortion can lead to infertility, this is part of the reason why, because of the scar tissue that occurs that is very, very common. Now, Brianna and her husband Aaron decide to go through with in vitro fertilization. They froze their eggs and they're trying to decide what to do with regard to a surrogate. And her mother, her healthy 51-year-old mother, who's an athlete, kept offering over and over again to be her surrogate. This story isn't that outlandish. I live in San Diego. It's a hotbed for surrogacy. I'm telling you, you can go to some of the NICU wards here in San Diego, visiting friends, loved ones, kids who are just born. You head to that NICU ward and guess what? I'm sorry to say, there are a lot of same-sex couples coming from other countries to pick up their child, their special order baby that they ordered, had a surrogate, end up gestating, and then give birth to, and then they fly out of the country and take their child away. It's heartbreaking to see. The good side is we see people wanting to be parents. But on the side that's not so great is that we're taking the child out of the context of marriage. We're taking the child out of the context and their due right to a mother and a father before these children are even created. We are already signing away the fact that they will never have a relationship with their parents. At times even signing away whether or not they will even have a male and a female presence in their life. Millennials are discovering the ideal of marriage, family, and having children too late. And they're trying desperately to take the pieces of their life together to assimilate what they want. We can change this. There is hope, but that requires that there's an example set for millennials. An example that shows marriage and family life as a good thing, not a hindrance to loving life, not a hindrance to personal development, but actually a success. A success by the virtue that's developed, the relationships that grow, the little people whose lives transform their own. I found that even just since I've been married these last couple of years, I find myself engaging with my single friends in a different way, welcoming them into our marriage, and even into our own struggle with fertility as it's occurred and the challenges that have come up during our own pregnancy. Because people who are single need to see this example that marriage is possible, but it also comes with it with its challenges. They need to see that it's a joyful opportunity. I know so many people who think to get married is to end your life, to no longer have that freedom and that free time. But that's not the case. Marriage is given to us as a covenant from God. God elevated it. Jesus Christ elevated marriage to the level of a sacrament. It's a vocation, one way, one path in life that we can take toward heaven, toward being with God. And this is where people, when they try to assimilate into a type of marriage or a parenthood situation, it's because they know that although they not only desire a child for their own pleasure, they also know that there's something that transforms within them, within their heart. This is what is so fundamental about St. John Paul II's theology of the body. He looks back to human anthropology. He looks back to the scripture from the beginning, and that we as human beings were ultimately made to be a gift to others. That we've received everything we have from God, and we are therefore meant to give it all back. To give it back to others, to give who we are. And there's no greater example of this than the motherhood of a woman. The biological motherhood, her body physically changes. I'm learning all of this as I myself am going through it. I remember at one point my husband and I were talking about it. You know, I come from a very active background, having danced my whole life since I was 3 years old. I'm a Pilates trainer, extremely physically active and athletic. And I remember as I became pregnant in the first trimester, especially because of my Hashimoto's disease, it was making me even more exhausted than pregnancy already is. And we were launching this daily radio show at the same time. And I remember my husband looking at me. He'd never seen me on the couch on my butt so much before. He kept looking at me going, "What's wrong?" He said, "I wanted to look at you and sometimes just say, get up, like you need to shake yourself out of this." And I'd remember, oh yeah, she's pregnant. She's having these symptoms. And it was a reminder for him. He looked at me at one point and said, "Wow, it's incredible. You're actually giving up your whole body. You're giving up the physical activity you love. You're giving up the way your body looks, everything for the sake of this child." And he's like, I don't think I could do that. We hear men say this all the time. I don't think it's possible. It's written into our bodies as women to give ourselves to others. And this is why, whether it's at 40 years old or even a 51-year-old mother offering to her daughter who's struggling with fertility to become her surrogate for that child, this is where we see this desire to give, but people don't always know how to give. And so this is where the beauty of the Catholic Church comes into play. Will we be bearers of light and saying, this is how you transform who you are. This is how you develop your character. This is how you become a gift of self. This is the model for marriage. Or will we just say, you know what, that's fine. Do it whatever way you want. You do you. As long as you get to having kids, as long as you get to, you know, some sort of marriage, as long as you get that great career spike, whatever it might be. What will we do? Will we live a relativistic type of mindset where we say anything goes and everything's right? Or will we say, no, your innate desire for motherhood is good, but let's talk about what that should look like and how it can bring about true joy, even if the circumstances have become difficult with fertility. Even if the circumstances have led you to be at a point in your life that you wish you weren't. Let's still seek after and chase virtue in our lives rather than settling for just what we want and the way we want it. I'll be back tomorrow for our Marriage Hour here with matchmaker Christina Pineda.